I'm fascinated with this topic generally that I'm about to approach, but and also I'm reading a book now, so that's the reason I'm asking the question. But the idea of ends of, you know, back in the 60s, all the French people were involved in the ends of man discussion, Foucault, Derrida, and Lyotard, and folks like that. And of course, a lot of it comes from Hegel in his discussion of the end of a certain state of affairs and the end of art, as art turns into much more abstract, philosophical sorts of enterprises. Do you see any evidence of things like that? And the reason why I've been reading a book on discourse on a rumor about the end of art by Hegel. So not the actual end of, but rumors about the end of art. Do you ever have a feeling that people are, it's exactly what you were saying, the simplification, which would be a kind of a capitulation, wouldn't it, to art historical currents by saying, I cannot deal with this process of increasing abstraction, interpretation, critical approaches, so I need to go back to my backyard, so to speak, and deal with my own little hut. One of my own interests, right. Of course, also.
Which you've done.
Right. And yet, if for one who is literate and a theory person, that can't be totally satisfying, though, can it? That sort of retreat. No, I don't know if I call it a retreat. Withdrawal. Or would you even characterize it as withdrawal from this huge network that's developed about ideas and interpretations and, you know, media productions?
It would definitely be a withdrawal and a reaction. For myself, it wouldn't work, mm-hmm. because I like to be caught up in the debris.
Mm-hmm.
The more dust, the better.
Right. Yeah.
Instead of simplifying, mm-hmm. but in context of where things might be going.
Mm-hmm. I think people are just getting generally overburdened, not only artists, but and in as much as artists are the canary in the mines, of course, artists would get overburdened first. Presumably, and want to say, okay, enough's enough. No cell phones, no computer, no email. Not going to any more movies for a while. In fact, I heard on the radio a couple in New York living in an apartment had decided to do a zero impact environmental impact lifestyle, wherein they aren't even using toilet paper. So, if you were a guest, I guess, I don't know what sort of provisions they would provide for that, but I think a lot of people want to go back to a sort of a primitivist lifestyle. Sometimes I have that feeling myself, but you never have that sort of urge to, well, you're living out in the country right now, though, right?
I'm living, not quite 19th century, but almost. I still have the water and electricity.
Mm-hmm. Well, a Gothic sensibility is basically what a 16th century.
Oh, that pushes it much further back.
Yeah.
And I don't know if this pertains to what you're saying, but the theorists that you were mentioning a short time ago, I categorize them in my mind as apartment dwellers.
Mm. Yeah.
That write in an apartment. Take a subway to the university, speak in the university, take the subway back.
So take a plane to another city, to another university, where you stay in an apartment.
So their world is very different.
Right.
But what fraction of the world actually lives that way?
Mm-hmm. Well, increasingly, in the United States anyway, the so-called developed countries, you know, the rural is disappearing. And even when you do go to live in the rural, it's a simulacrum of it, increasingly, where, you know, they are reproductions, like in Florida, where Disney is doing, you know, little quaint villages and like that. So the organic aspect of living in a community seems to be rapidly disappearing, too, in favor of a reproduction or a simulacrum of it to some degree, which I think people want to get back to some sort of genuine, authentic, put that in scare quotes, authentic sort of relationship to life and production of their artifacts, but just becomes very difficult, which is where an artist comes in, I guess, or one should become an artist if one wants to live that kind of life.
Mm. Right. It's kind of like a long-term tourism.
Mm-hmm.
Where you're
consisting
arriving,
of one's life.
Yes, you're arriving at a neighborhood to live in that you've never lived in.
Mm-hmm.
You have no nostalgia about mm-hmm. it because you've mm-hmm. never achieved that. And instead of staying for a week, you're there for mm-hmm. 5 years,
mm-hmm.
and then move to the Southwest.
Mm-hmm.
Where there's something with a Native American theme about a Native American tribe that was actually Northwest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you believe in the afterlife?
This is a difficult thing because I think we're focused in the middle of an afterlife.
Mm.
After many years of tossing various mega theories about. The one that keeps coming back to me is the writings generally referred to as the Seth material.
Yes, I'm familiar with that. Mm-hmm. Which, could you explain what that is?
That would take many, many hours. generally, it's probably the heart of the you create your own reality concept. So as far as afterlife, that's as many afterlives as you want to have.
Mm-hmm.
And we're focused in one particular one now, which is an afterlife to something else.
Mm-hmm.
But we've all chosen these roles for a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
So our goal that we've set for ourselves is to play this through.
So you think that the personality somehow goes forward in some sort of infinite sense, or is it a pattern of energy, or is that even germane to the approach you would take?
It's a pattern of energy. Far as forward, all time is simultaneous.
Right, yeah.
So
yeah.
It's all happening at once. And the personality might carry, in a strong way, or the contradiction of that personality,
mm-hmm.
Whichever role that we care to choose.
Mm-hmm. Let's see what I have written here. We talked about the Atlanta art scene. Of course, you're living outside the city, so you're kind of on the outskirts of. But you do come into iDrum occasionally. In fact, we're sitting in iDrum right now.
We are in iDrum right now. We are the event that's happening now. But this is a recording.
I should do these on stage and just, you know, video record them at the same time as we're doing the audio recording.
Well, you have my permission to do that.
Okay.
With this voice.
Yeah. Do you have any topics that you're, I have one or two more, but do you have any topics that you have there that we haven't covered about your own
work? I have one hot one that I would certainly like to mention.
Hot one?
Yes. To me, and not just in Atlanta, but anywhere that I've been, the most consistently interesting exhibitions that I've seen
mm-hmm.
Are something you can go see right now. It would be in the dog toy aisle of the large, whichever pet supermarket that you like to go to.
Interesting. How did this and fascination with dog toys come
about? It's easy to say, go take a look, go take a look. It's within a very limited scope what manufacturers have done with a certain amount of materials, concepts that are completely open-ended, but all refer back to the same experience, which is not a dog chewing something, but a host of a dog buying something for the dog to chew. That's the experience.
Mm-hmm.
And the designs are open-ended. So you have this short range of materials from bone and dried flesh to I don't know how many kinds of plastics are not allowed, but all that are allowed are certainly there. And this seemingly endless variety of designs that they will put this to, designs that are far, far more complex than they have to be.
Huh.
Not just to interest the dog, but to interest the buyer.
Mm-hmm.
There are
as the host for the dog.
As the host, exactly. Right. As the host wanting to spend. I have seen plastic dog toys going for over $20.
Oh my God!
And these things are, well, it's obvious to say that they resemble sex toys, but also models of spacecraft, futuristic items. The whole history of puppetry is in there, is in that aisle. So if you recall the exhibit that Alan McCollum, I believe I have the name right.
Multiples.
The multiples, mm-hmm. Right. This is the multiples without the limits that he gave it.
Hmm.
He gave certain limits of material and size.
Well, I guess they are sex toys in a way if you consider that our pets are a very desiring and desirable other that we have constructed for ourselves.
They're surrogates.
They're surrogates for a lot of different ways and a lot of different times, people, you know, they definitely figure into a desiring mechanism. And so the intermediary stage or the fetishistic stage of approaching that desirable other is the dog toy or the pet toy. Fascinating.
Yeah. And the senses as well, because you not only have the various sense that people, as well as animals, would like in them, mm-hmm. the visual colors
mm-hmm.
And forms, the tastes mm-hmm. that go along with them, and the sound.
Mm-hmm.
Sound. A lot of them have sound integrated into them.
Hmm. How did you get interested in, obviously you're still interested in dogs, bringing up the dog toy thing. You've done three dogs, you said. Why the dogs specifically? Because it's such a companion animal for humans, along with cats, or why the dog?
The dogs specifically because they are the domestic animal. They cats have a large number of people that claim to hate them,
mm-hmm.
so that wouldn't be the same category.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the dog and what we project onto mm-hmm. the dog, and because it's about as far from a material expected in an art gallery environment as mm-hmm. as I could conceive of.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, they're not really sure what the evolutionary sequence of the dog is. I've seen several programs on TV about it. People think, well, yeah, it came from the wolf, but there's a lot of evidence that it did not come from a wolf. And if you do a web search on the evolution of the dog, you'll find a lot of questions about where the dog came from evolutionarily. And they're still researching that, but it's still kind of up in the air about, because, for example, wolves are a very pack animal. They're very, you know, it's hard to think of being able to domesticate a wolf because of the characteristics of the wolf itself. And they tend to go feral very quickly, even if they've been, quote, domesticated for a while. They still remain very wild. So they don't have the initial characteristics that would be good for a domestic dog, I guess. But, you know, as the natural world disappears, you know, our pets are going to become the one link to that. But even that link, we're basically engineering out of them. The domestic dog, like I said, is not very similar to the wolf. The form of the body, and that it's a canis, you know, kind of thing.
And it has inherent vice because of the way they've been bred.
Which are our vices, I guess, right?
Yes. Some have joint disorders
mm-hmm.
Because of their shapes. And I've heard that I don't know if this is true, but poodles, yes, breathing, and poodles being prone to epilepsy.
Hmm.
I don't know if that's true.
Well, maybe this ties in with a thing I heard recently, that there are groups of disabled people who want to have the right, through genetic research, to create disabled children for themselves. That is, if they are sightless or cannot hear, they would like their children to be sightless and not hear, or whatever disability they would have. Of course, it's very controversial because it goes against really a lot of basic tenets of Western civilization.
And there's still adoption.
Yeah. But animals, you know, ranging on a sort of a science fiction scenario or a gothic scenario, as it were, but, you know, it's easy to see that we could create animals with disabilities. Already we now have animals that will try to compensate for disabilities, seeing eye dogs, etc. I think there are even some monkeys that have been trained to help people. So we're developing an uncanny sort of doubled relationship with our pets and with our computers and with our machines. We're sort of creating the tableaus that you present in some of your work, this sort of empty space waiting to be filled by something, right? I don't know if there's a question in there or not, but comment, you know, I guess, if you want. Parrots, for example, I just finished reading a book by John Carter, very interesting book on parrots. Parrots, you know, do not speak in the wild. They only speak in captivity. And that just is so redolent of a lot of things about slavery and captivity and imprisonment and knowledge. And but his point also is that parrots are sort of an intermediary position with nature, which is what our pets are generally. And what art is, I guess, to some degree, you know.
Mm. And elephants draw.
Elephants draw. Chimpanzees draw and,
yes.
And gorillas draw.
And chimpanzees sign to open the cage.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Maybe at some point we'll come to think that animals are the only authentic relationship with nature, and humans are so contorted and perverted by the machinery that we are. We can't say that we've created machinery, because we are machinery. We have been. That's, machines came from us, right? And so animals, maybe we'll see to be pure. And I guess we do, to some degree. That's kind of a PC thing, you know, like with kids, protect the animals, protect the kids, right? Which is why, I guess, your three-headed dog really throws a monkey wrench into people's expectations.
Well,
it's not a very pure creature.
Yeah. Oh, not at all, not at all. And in also, each time that I did one of the dog pieces, I adopted a dog.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really? Interesting.
Just that was part of the piece. I've used a dog in this piece. Down to the dog pound I go and adopt another one.
And so you've got three dogs now?
Well, this has been over the years.
They die and
yeah.
they
of natural causes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now it's down to two.
Mm. Well, your studio, I've been out to your studio, and thanks for inviting me out that delightful time with
sure.
dinner, but it's a very, some people would be a little weirded out by your studio. It's a lot of very macabre bits and pieces scattered throughout there.
It's the world.
Yeah.
That's what's in the world.
Right, yeah.
I've put it in one place and put a light on it.
Mm-hmm. I remember you had a German book of autopsy photos out at that time.
Oh, crime scene photos.
Crime scene photos.
Crime scene photos from the 1900 through, let's say, the 1930s.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering why, since you have an interest in tableaus, and I'm thinking of Gregory Crudson, who does stage tableaus, and I think there are other people who do it, but Crudson's stuff I like. That's sort of uncanny quality to it. But I'm wondering why you haven't gone to photography some with, you have so many great pieces and props and to create the same sort of thing as the paint. I know that paint has a very sensuous quality to it for you, but have you considered doing photographic tableaus of similar to what you do painting-wise?
I have always considered that. I think what I'm waiting for is for, I don't know if I'll see that in this lifetime, but I'm waiting for a film to become even more obsolete than it is now. it's as I understand it from being outside the field, it's just rapidly becoming a fine art media.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. You know, now they have film is digitized from at the studios. It's sent to, I think, to satellites, and it's sent down to the theaters. So it's become, there are a couple of theaters in town that do that. There's no transportation of a physical medium. It's turned into bits and bytes and transmitted. So the physicalness of seeing film projected, for example, when Andy Ditzler does 16mm film nights here, there's a really glorious quality to that projected image, unlike video, very different. Even though David Lynch's latest film, Inland Empire, was done all in video, which I take was some sort of comment about something. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't.
I recommend it.
I understand what you say about film, because it's the presence of the light, the actual casting of the light, and also, gosh, for me, I have to hear the whir of the projector somewhere in the back.
I'm wondering, you know, I've been reading a lot of things about theology, but I'm, for some reason, I don't know exactly why, but film takes on a sort of a theological sort of aspect of, because of the light. If you look back at theological traditions, the aspect of light, I don't care whether it's Islamic traditions or all the Abrahamic religions and Buddhism, I guess also Hinduism, light figures and the projections of light and the coming forth of light figures very prominently. And I guess as we move into a different kind of culture, where the light, you know, from video is a different kind of quality. It's, you know, it's kind of the bits and pieces are reconstituted inside the brain rather than having actual images out there. Like if you're a dog or a bird, I guess you see entirely different kind of image making. You know, if you see all the rasters across a screen, you know. Do you ever think about theological issues much? I mean, we were talking about metaphysical earlier. I don't know that those are exactly the same. But do you ever think? The reason why I bring this up is religion is now permeating the air everywhere we.
They are overlapping concepts. I tend not to use those concepts in the work because I don't want to be too specific with what the partial truth that I'm trying, and religion is seldom about partial truth.
That's true.
For his film in theology, wouldn't the omniscience of the film, to me, would be one of the main aspects of it having a theological bent.
Would you say that would you characterize yourself as having a pagan sensibility? And I say that because of the emphasis on objects, and often. And I'm shoehorning a lot of stuff in here, but just you know, in order to be able to have a discussion here in terms of my interest in all things theological recently. Is that a fair question to ask you? Being paganistic interest, and I take that to mean a kind of a pantheistic nature worship. Emphasis on sort of effects rather than that ultimate wholeness, omniscience that you were talking about.
I do use the objects for effects, but they're like tools. They're like tools that I can set aside when I've done with that, rather than honoring the same tool for every application.
So you would not consider yourself to have any sensibility along the lines of, gosh, well, I don't even know exactly what I'm. Because your work itself it's haunted by something, either. Maybe haunted by the lack of something, or to me it does, haunting by the presence of something, or the lack of something, most often the lack of something.
The substitutes.
Right.
The things that we will accept as a substitute for something that's ineffable.
Yeah.
To begin with.
Right. Well, I guess it's the ineffability, your relationship to those ineffable, non-comprehensible, unreadable sorts of things. Do you think it's necessary to have some idea about what that is, or just to present them?
I present them with enough indices in this culture for the audience in this culture to read them, and I don't think I can do any more than that.
Right.
because I want multiple interpretations. Mm-hmm. If a piece is just interpreted one way, I think it's a failure.
It's a boring thing, right? Yeah, yeah, exactly. Also, it will change through time, you know, the longer it hangs around. Well, do you have shows coming up anytime soon?
I have a show as soon as I can make it work. it's the one that involves a lot of areas that I haven't worked in before, media that I haven't used.
Oh, really?
Before. So
okay.
I not only have to make something out of it, but it has to be presentable as well. Mm. So
this will be film or video or. Or photography,
it will be a little bit of all of those.
Oh, really?
All of those, and sound, and motion,
and we're talking about installation, or
and an installation, and objects, yes,
and the second coming of Christ.
Yes, only on the opening night.
Okay. All right. Well, I will definitely try to make it, and I urge anybody who hasn't seen your work to look it up. Do you have any material on the web that? People can view.
The gallery does. Yeah,
the gallery.
A search for E.K. Huckabee.
Okay.
We'll bring that up. Actually, a search for a single word will bring that up.
What's the word?
The word dysiatrics.
Dysiatrics. That's right. Yes. How would you? What's the definition of that word?
The practice of making mistakes.
Ah, yes. Yeah. Mistakes are very and failure is very very valuable. I don't think people. Mainstream people in this culture that is not artists really understand the value of failure. If you can't, I mean, failure
beyond
is more important than success, right?
Beyond entertainment value.
But beyond, yes. No, exactly. Yeah. And that's a whole other discussion about the place of, I guess, failure and entertainment. But it's been great. And I was going to ask you one more question, actually. Do you have any favorite artists?
Let's see.
In town or out, you know, nationally, or just to give you some kind of
that come to mind. The one that floats right up to the top now is the Chapman Brothers.
Ah, of course,
because they're so crass.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And productive and crafty.
Right, all in the same time, and they've got like a whole production team, I guess, to. Do you ever wish you had like a team of people? Like, do you have more ideas than you do ability to produce?
I don't know how this sounds, but I have more ideas than I have time to produce. The ability sometimes is limited with every piece. I wouldn't know what to do with a team.
Yeah,
I'm so accustomed to doing everything myself that. Mm-hmm. I guess the team could walk the dog first, and then we'll see.
Walk the three-headed dog, right? Okay, well, thanks again, E.K., and we'll be looking for your next project at Solomon Projects, I guess, coming with some new media.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Thanks for coming out.
Thanks.